KZSU-FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law and affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today I'm very excited to have on two guests that I've wanted to have on the show for quite a while, and I'm very excited that we are able to get together today via Skype and the wonders of technology to talk about a topic which has gotten a lot of attention in the last few years, and that raises very important broad questions about privacy and access to information and how individuals interact with technology today. This doctrine, this idea, is what is known as the right to be forgotten. The right to be forgotten is a data protection idea that has emanated from the European Union, designed to allow individuals to ultimately, to some degree, choose what information about them is available on the internet. It is a doctrine born out of privacy concerns, but one that has been highly controversial, one that EU regulators have struggled with and has some interesting challenges if you attempt to port it over to countries like the United States, not to mention other countries where privacy concerns are not a concern. Both Julia and Ellen have spent extensive time over the last several years trying to understand the right to be forgotten, but also attempting to get information from the right to be forgotten's primary target, which is Google, about how Google handles requests made by internet users asking for information to be removed from their search. That is a challenge. As we know, and anyone who's listened to Hearsay Culture for a while knows, one of the big topics on the show is access to information generally. What information would we like to know? What information do we not need to know? What information do we really need to know? And trying to understand what we should expect from an entity like Google vis-a-vis transparency on something like the right to be forgotten is a challenging and fascinating issue. In addition, of course, we have broad questions about speech, which also the right to be forgotten raises issues about. We're going to discuss those as well. And we're going to think more broadly towards the end of the interview about how platforms operate within this sphere and how governments interact with these speech platforms like Google and what powers they ultimately have to act to change what they do, impact what they do, or ultimately control what they do. So this is a topic that you start with this right to be forgotten idea, which is fascinating in its own right, but then really moves to much broader issues that we've talked about on Hearsay Culture for the last 10 years. So I'm very excited to have these two wonderful guests on today. By way of very brief introduction, one of our guests today is Professor Ellen Goodman from Rutgers Law School. She specializes in information policy law and writes on a variety of areas, including the right to be forgotten. She is the co-director and co-founder of the Rutgers Institute for Information Policy and Law. She also blogs there as well as Medium.com, and she is joining us via Skype from right outside Philly. Also joining us today is Julia Powles. Julia is both affiliated with the University of Cambridge as well as a reporter who has covered a lot of these issues exceptionally well for The Guardian. She has a fascinating background in the world of IP, including being a speechwriter for the Director General of the World Intellectual Property Organization. She has also been involved in the administrative appeals in Australia. She has a fascinating background as well, working in innovation areas, including affiliations with the Max Planck Institute for Innovation and Competition, which has done terrific work, not only in Europe, but also in bridging U.S. and EU scholars on these issues. And she is joining us from via Skype from Cambridge. We are recording the show on January 22nd, 2016. We are recording via Skype. You may hear this if you're listening closely. You may hear and wonder if Levine has a little bit of a cold, and the answer is yes, but I'm going to do my best to make that as non-annoying as possible. Ellen and Julia, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks.
Ellen, let me start off, and then I'll go to Julia. I always ask this question of my guests. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you came to focus on the right to be forgotten, both the issue itself and the broader policy concerns.
My background is in media law, mostly American media law, but also European media law. So I come to this from sort of the journalism perspective and I guess a bias towards free speech and a battle between free speech and privacy. Although one thing I do want to say is that it's often those two values are often posed against each other. And of course, privacy is an important component in generating free speech. So I don't view them as antagonistic. But so that's where, and so I followed with interest the 2014 Right to be Forgotten decision in Europe, and I've also been interested in the power of platforms as speech mediators. And I was also following with interest Julia Powell's writing on this. And so we started talking about how we were both frustrated that there wasn't more transparency about how the platforms, which had been tasked with implementing the Right to be Forgotten, which we'll talk about, they had been sort of enlisted, dragged in against their will to implement this rule of law. And we were both frustrated by how little we knew about how they were actually doing that.
Julia?
So I have, I'm also interested in information law and intellectual property. I actually come to the Right to be Forgotten specifically by way of a bet, which was that I went to a lecture, I think in 2010, at the University of Cambridge with the former Spanish data protection advisor, who was talking about a slew of cases that were sitting in the Spanish authority under the 1995 Data Protection Directive. And looking at the letter of the law and the cases of these individuals who were claiming that certain results on Google were either inaccurate, out of date, or inaccurately represented them, I thought that there was a pretty strong case on the law, and that if a court looked at that law seriously, they would probably find in favor of the complainants, and that that was going to throw a bit of a spanner in the works. And I had a beer with a friend and said, if that indeed is the case, I'd like to get involved and wrestle with some of the issues. So when it was before the court in 2013 and again in 2014, I was writing for Wired and said, oh, look out, this case is coming next week. It's probably going to be a curveball. Nobody expected it. But in fact, yeah, what the Spanish director had said those years before seemed to come true, which is that the law does really offer some quite significant rights of erasure and correction. And I think that the label, the right to be forgotten, is somewhat misleading, but implemented just from those rights that have been in the law for a long time, the case that these, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about the details of the case, but that these individuals brought really had quite some merit. So, yeah, that's how I got involved.
Yeah, Julie, you just said something in that answer which is a wonderful segue to kind of define this, because you just said that the right to be forgotten is a bit of a misnomer, and you referred to erasure and correction. So if you would, if you can continue in that vein, give us what your understanding of the right to be forgotten is versus what the colloquial or public understanding of it is, particularly in the EU, and of course we'll extend that beyond the EU.
Yeah, so I think it's quite useful to just, I don't know whether listeners are familiar with the framework of European data protection law. For many, the right to be forgotten, being such a spectacularly public case, has been the first introduction many internet users may have had to data protection law. And it emerged out of some anxieties of quite forward-thinking individuals in Europe in the 60s. And 70s around large industrial databases, well before anyone was thinking about networked computing and the internet. And it was really about when you have increasing profiles on individuals held in these governmental databases specifically, and there were anxieties particularly from civilian jurisdictions and Germany in particular, what are the consequences for individuals of having incorrect information held on them or by the authorities that shouldn't still retain that information after a certain purpose is exhausted. And so that was the motivation for the data protection, for various rules that were made in Europe in the 80s and then were implemented as an EU-wide directive in 1995. And they include rights where information is out of date or inaccurate to have that data, a data subject can request that information about them is removed or that it's corrected. There was a feeling that this, it's never really been reconciled how this applies to various internet operators and particularly to search engines. There was some ambiguity. A colleague of mine, David Erdos, did a very interesting empirical study in 2013 where he asked European data protection authorities how these rules about erasure and correction apply to search engines and found that half of the authorities in Europe were ambiguous about whether it did or did not apply. And that was really the core of the legal issue in the right to be forgotten ruling that went up to the highest court in Europe in 2014, which was to what extent do these rules of erasure and correction and other subject access requirements and so on apply to search engines and to the public web? And amazingly, despite that law being on the books since 95, that question in its real scope hadn't yet been addressed. And I think the right to be forgotten is really, in that sense, on the beginning of it. So I said it's not really about the right to be forgotten. I think forgetting is a complex human emotion, and to talk about forgetting in as a legal right is very problematic. It creates strong knee-jerk reactions, understandably. It's critical to human trust and development and societies that we have processes of remembering and forgetting, and you can't force somebody to forget. Really what it is though about the institutional memory on individuals, where that could be harmful. And that goes back to those origins and anxieties about what would happen if you didn't have processes for some degree of institutional forgetting, you know, as we have around rehabilitation of offenders and so on, that after a certain amount of time, you're not required to have past events very prominent in your current life and activities so that you have room to mature and develop in the world.
Ellen, if I can so on the misnomer aspect of the right to be forgotten, it's important to understand the limited scope of the holding in the EU. So it only applies on a search of a person's name. So if Dave Levine were involved in a personal bankruptcy, and that was something that was inaccurate or no longer accurate or fell under the scope of the ruling, then when I searched on Dave Levine, I would not find that because the data controller would have delisted it. However, the underlying information would still be there. So if I search some other way, personal bankruptcies in a particular jurisdiction, and Dave Levine's name came up, it would still be there. And so the term erasure or obliteration or the right to be forgotten also evokes this idea, is not quite accurate. So I think people prefer the term delisting. So it's delisting or de-indexed from a name, but the information is still there. It's just harder to find. The other just annotation of Julia's point that I wanted to make was, you know, just to highlight the difference between EU law and American law, this idea that where there are large databases that individuals should have the right to know what portfolio is being assembled on them and then to correct mistakes. This is sort of a basic tenet of fair information practices, and it's a tenet that sort of U.S. institutions and government institutions have accepted in principle since the 70s. However, it has never been implemented in the U.S. as it has in the EU in a big omnibus data protection law. And so you do see that principle in specific statutes such as Fair Credit Reporting Act, where individuals have the right to know what data is in their credit reports and to correct any mistakes. I think so in the U.S. it exists in pockets but doesn't exist as such a strong right and such an encompassing right. And I should say what's particularly interesting from an American perspective about the right to be forgotten as it applies to search engines is that we as a society have been a little ambivalent, as has, you know, Silicon Valley, about the posture of these platforms vis-a-vis journalism, vis-a-vis the media. Are they media institutions, media platforms, or are they technology companies? And generally, they prefer to be considered technology companies, and generally the law treats them that way. We can talk about this later, but in many respects, they are coming to behave more like media platforms. And so this particular intervention, the right to be forgotten, really puts that question sort of in the crosshairs.
And that issue, which I think is appropriate to talk about now, which is the exact role of Google, not only within the right to be forgotten, but more broadly in access to information, is critical. And I think the way to frame that, maybe I'll ask you this question, Ellen, and then I'll come to Julia, what is a very procedural and basic question. If I am an internet user and I want something "quote unquote" removed, right, or corrected, right, in Google search, what is the process that I use to even make that request in the U.S. versus, and Julia, what I want to ask you is, how does it actually work in terms of the nuts and bolts in the EU? So, what would happen here, Ellen, if here in the United States, I mean, if I wanted to take something off of Google?
Well, people have, you know, tried to do this. You would contact Google, or you would contact the publisher, publisher of the information that Google is referring you to. That would probably be your first stop, and try to get the publisher to take it down, or try to get Google to de-index it. I don't know how many, you know, I don't think we have any data on how many requests like that from Americans Google receives, because of course there's no equivalent of the right to be forgotten, and it doesn't appear in their transparency reports. So I don't think we know how common that is. My hunch is that it's very unlikely to be successful.
Julia?
So Google's had in place for some time a very narrow band of information that if it appears in search results, you can make a direct request, and they actually will remove it from the index. So that's where there's situations of that present, in their terms, clear and imminent harm. So of identity theft or financial fraud. So if your credit card details are made available. And that has, again, yeah, Ellen's absolutely right. We don't know the numbers on that. There's also this rather curious thing that under the generous DMCA notice and takedown procedure for copyright, many people, that was how, in that famous incident last year with the celebrity photos that were uploaded, copyright law was used to take results off Google. Those requests are enormous, in the millions. It's absolutely, they outnumber privacy requests 1,000 to 1, and they are processed within 6 hours at a 97% acceptance rate. So a lot of information is being removed from Google. And I think your question, Dave, has been at the heart of the media discussion of this, which is, what is the role of Google? And really some questioning about the role of platforms and whether what they present as neutral and organic search results are really such. If you have removals for things like copyright, if you start to have removals in this more grey area of personal information. But there is this sort of narrow core that everybody accepts should be removed of harmful personal information. That was expanded slightly a year ago to include revenge porn, which was very interesting, and Google didn't connect it to the right to be forgotten. But my suspicion from some from what we've been able to identify, which is limited, of the requests that have been made and the volume of them, is that quite a number of revenge porn requests were coming through the right to be forgotten procedure, and that there was a recognition that this was quite an issue. A number of other platforms, particularly Twitter and Facebook, had taken action on this, and Reddit, and so Google wanted to action that. So there's now a global right in the US as well to a process that Google has instituted for requests about revenge porn. And Ellen and I spoke about this, and that's kind of problematic. What if you have a public figure, for example, and it may be, we can think of famous incidents in recent history where that has become a media of media interest. So these are often have shades of grey around the edges of the particular categories. The expansion of the European ruling was to take Google actually interpreted this ruling as requiring that it needed to institute a procedure for general right to be forgotten requests. And it interpreted the ruling in a particular way and created an online form that anyone with a connection to Europe can use. And you specify a URL, you specify the reasons why the information within that URL is out of date or inaccurate, and then Google does some black box procedure and decides whether or not it is going to delist that result. And some of the things in their transparency report as to what things would be delisted is if, for example, there's information about a person's medical history, they might be, the information might be about that they were a victim of a crime. There were several examples that Google's given about victims of rape, of crime a long time ago, and things that wouldn't be removed were if there was somebody, there was a request by, you know, clear criminal cases where they want information about convictions removed, public officials who want removal of information about their political opinions. So there's this sort of ad hoc decision-making going on. These are just some of the public examples that are given as to how those individual requests have been sorted. But something that Ellen and I have taken up and tried to pursue over the last year is whether we could get some more fine-grained understanding of how those sorts of requests break down. Is, for example, the revenge porn situation, a very significant proportion of these requests, or only a small part, how much of these requests concern information that involves the media or traditional journalistic publications, and so on.
So, Julia, and we're chatting with Julia Pals and Ellen Goodman on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Julia, I want to continue with you on that point and then come to Ellen on this because, and I should have said this up front, but I'll disclose it now. So you both, as I mentioned, both of you have worked tirelessly, it seems, to attempt to get Google to be more forthcoming with regard to data about how they apply this. I should have said by way of disclosure that I, among many others, signed on to your letters seeking that disclosure. How forthcoming has Google been? And to the extent, and I'm asking you, Julie, as a reporter, and I really want to ask Ellen kind of the same question as an academic, how you feel about it. But how forthcoming have they been? And to the extent that they haven't been forthcoming, are there decent reasons why they wouldn't or shouldn't be? So I'll continue with you, Julie, and then Ellen kind of asks the same question.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Transparency reporting is something that Google, to its credit, initiated, but as a result, it also has set the standard for others. And I think the reports that Google puts on its they're linked under their transparency report pages, for example, on copyright. They don't mention anything about trademark takedowns, but they're quite a significant proportion as well. Within a month of this ruling and commencing processing, they had up a transparency report. And I noticed, I was actually contacted by a number of journalists to offer comment on this. And the transparency report is beautifully packaged for newspaper copy because it includes some gross figures, which allow headlines such as Europe overwhelmed by right to be forgotten requests, and no relative, for example, that perspective that those requests are outnumbered quite, threefold by three orders of magnitude, by copyright requests and so on. And then they had 14 examples, again, many of which would have provoked quite strong reactions. Oh, my gosh, there are pedophile priests making requests to Google to remove information and, perhaps not including the information. And that was rejected, as rightly it should be, under any interpretation of the law. So I found very – so that was way back in May 2014, and I contacted Google at the time and made some requests about getting data that was within from one of the news publications I was working for, and had no real luck there, and was told, well, we're innovating on transparency reports and we intend to provide more. And that was sort of the answer for about a year. And I was becoming increasingly frustrated by, in fact, many public officials sort of steering clear of this burgeoning private decision-making that was happening without really interrogating. And one thing that was very interesting, a colleague of mine, Paul Bernal, who has a background in accountancy, noticed that the figures for acceptances were staying on an absolute static line, which suggested that there might be some targets being met to have a nice figure. I think it was 30% of requests are accepted, and that looks like, you know, probably some good internal rules are being followed. You know, 30%, it's not too much, it's not too little. And in fact, that was the response I had from some DPAs when I said, how can the public have any assurance that these decisions that are completely in a black box are applying the law properly? And they said, well, you know, many cases are being rejected. We don't have many appeals. 30%, you know, it looks good. So I thought this needed some more interrogation. So having been rebuffed personally a bit and talking with many others, and Ellen was really had also had for several months been looking into this, we decided to marshal, to the extent it's academics have any well, we can utilize the neutrality and spirit of inquiry. And so we had a number of academics who'd been working on this from various perspectives, and really a sense that all of our perspectives could be improved by having access to the data. I was also quite surprised that some scholars who are very pro-privacy were very critical of the right to be forgotten. I thought that some of their reactions suggested weren't held out by what I knew anecdotally about the data and so on. So we made this request to get more information on after a year after the ruling was made, and that didn't it produced at least some more dialogue and more assurances that we'd have more data, but ultimately there was no real response to that. There was some on background information provided by Google, but nothing that they wanted to disclose publicly. They ended up releasing 3 months worth of data purely on reasons for refusing requests, but not on reasons for accessing requests, and they were at a very general level. So there's still not a lot of information about the statistics. Now, you said, Dave, why would they do this? I think that right. There's a very reasonable concern that you could have a serious litigation exposure from looking at individual cases, making individual cases public. But that was never the intention of what we were trying to do. We were trying to understand where balances are being made, what are the sorts of issues, for example, in the collision between media publications. You know, what extent are these requests being made about media publications, for example, and what balances should be taken into account? Because, of course, there's the original source of that information, as well as Google's republishing, and should responsibilities fall differently between media organisations and Google? And I think many in the media were interested in that sort of balance and how you look at archives and so on. And so really it was to try to generate more information. And I think there is a concern about individual cases being transparent. The overall statistics, I think that really is just when you are the one setting the standard for transparency reporting. And sadly, Microsoft, which did make some improvements on its Transparency Hub reporting, didn't at all offer anything more on the right to be forgotten. So Google really has had the opportunity to both set the procedure that's being applied for this, as well as how it's reported publicly. And there's no freedom of information processes that you can apply against a private company as opposed to an authority. And equally, the authorities haven't been particularly transparent in how they've processed appeals. But appeals have been a very minor. It suggests that Google is applying good balances. There's been only 1% or something of cases that have been appealed. So I think that it would actually be to... I can see primarily benefits from making this information more widely available, but The other thing that it may do, which would be against Google's interest, is to create a more global demand, because if these are reasonable requests, for example, over sensitive medical, sexual information and so on, it may be that that's something that people in other parts of the world and not just in Europe would like to have the access to.
We're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. I'm going to dispense with my normal public service announcement here and go straight to Ellen. Ellen, if, to follow up on Julia's point, two points. A, you know, from an academic perspective, what's your take on Google's transparency, or to the extent you want to frame it that way, lack thereof, and what's your broader take on what responsibility Google has to the public to be clear about how it's applying the directive?
Well, I mean, I would separate out instances in which Google has been enlisted by public authorities to do a job from instances in which Google itself is taking on a filtering role or augmenting its filtering role. In the first instance, which is the right to be forgotten, you know, I think principally the principal obligation lies with the public authorities that are asking Google to fulfill this role. So if we want more transparency, and you know, I should say the EU had an advisory group and they did urge, they wanted to see transparency, but Google has not been required to be more transparent. So I think it's, although we would like more transparency, you know, Google's a private company, and if we really want it, then we ought to require it as part of this package of obligations we are imposing on Google. Now, having said that, and you know, in our conversations, and in, you know, I should say, we can see that there's conflicting DNA and within a company like Google. We focused on Google because it's proportion of right to be forgotten requests so dwarfs those made to any other company like Bing. You can see sort of conflicting strains within Google and within technology companies in general. So on the one hand, they like transparency, and you know, Google, I think, got the highest score in the Ranking Digital Rights Corporate Accountability Project, which ranked companies according to their commitment to human rights, including privacy and free expression. So the investigators who worked on that project clearly found lots to appreciate in how Google goes about being a steward of information, and transparency was among the indicia they used. So Google likes transparency. On the other hand, of course, it guards with the utmost fervor the secrecy of its algorithms and its methodologies for filtering and presenting information. So these two competing principles, you know, one can see at play in its responses to our attempts to get more information. So having said that, I would like public authorities to require more transparency, and being somewhat sympathetic to Google's claims that if it discloses more fine-grained information, it's then at risk at defeating the purpose of the right to be forgotten by infringing on privacy rights. It does baffle me why Google can't release some of the aggregate data we've been requesting. So, for example, we have asked that it disclose what percentage of requests that it gets are in the category of public figures, or in the category of minors, or in the category of people asking that records of crimes be delisted. So, you know, this kind of aggregate data would not seem to put Google in any way at risk of violating personal privacy, or being in violation of the Data Protection Directive or the Consejo, which is the right to be forgotten order. So I think we should expect more transparency even in the absence of a direct order. Now, on the other class of actions, those right. that Google is taking itself, just Julia mentioned the revenge porn decision, you know, which I think many of us applaud as being the right decision, but I'll just read to you from Google's blog, which announced this decision. It said, going forward, we'll honor requests from people to remove nude or sexually explicit images shared without their consent from Google search results. And then it goes on to say this is a narrow and limited policy. And it also says they're going to treat these requests much like they treat removal requests for highly sensitive personal information like bank account numbers. They say it's limited. That's a broad category, nude or explicit images shared without your consent. Probably broader than most of us think of revenge porn being. So there seems to be a gap between revenge porn and that description. There is no transparency about how many such requests they've had, how much they have removed. Google's not implementing any government policy. I can't see a reason why they shouldn't disclose, and they won't be ordered to disclose because it isn't a government policy, why they shouldn't disclose more in the aggregate to help us understand how they're shaping our information environment and how prevalent this problem is.
So we're chatting with Ellen Goodman of Rutgers and Julia Powles of Cambridge and The Guardian on KZFM and Stanford Hearsay's Culture. Huge issues. And I do want to, and I know, Julia, you're on a bit of a tighter schedule, so I do want to come back to you. And then, Ellen, I think we'll wind up chatting a bit one-on-one towards the end of the show. Julia, Ellen mentioned something, and you've alluded to it, which I think gives the right to be forgotten a much more grounded and also, I think, expansive understanding. You've alluded, Julia, to copyright issues. There's also and the relationship of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the notice and takedown provisions under Section 512, which has been a focus of Hearsay Culture. But for those that don't remember, this is the process for removing, let's say, allegedly copyright infringing works from YouTube. But we also have, of course, the specter today in discussions about things like whether encryption should be used in communication and how the internet can be used to allow militants and terrorists to communicate. The specter of terrorism and national security as being a right to be forgotten issue, and so I'd like to ask you, Julia, again from an EU perspective in particular, right? The government or governments generally, of course, have an interest in controlling networks to prevent crimes, right? And of course, the public would, generally speaking, have that interest as well. How does the right to be forgotten as a doctrine and as an idea fit with these broader concerns about the use of technology in ways that are not only socially harmful, but in the case of terrorism and militantism, literally life or death?
Yeah, so it's interesting because many of the commentators on the right to be forgotten have made this connection between the concern about governments wanting to control access to information, and that this somehow facilitates that in a strong way. I really don't see that at all. I mean, the situation at the moment is that, and I find it quite interesting in internet policy generally, that you get this polarization between either the free and open internet or championed by the US and other its allies, and or you get the closed internet, and that somehow once you start to introduce legal capacity to have individuals act on information about them that's collected wrongly and or maybe inaccurate, that somehow that this will lead to closure of the web. And I mean, my response to that generally is that governments within their own jurisdiction do all sorts of things to control information. In the US, there's a lot of controls around gambling, for example. In the UK, there's a lot around child abuse. In China, there's different controls again, and they're very culturally contingent. And in Germany, where I've just been, there's many controls and concerns that are historically informed, and that. Those set of issues, to me, I think are very distinct from what rights individuals have when there's information that is made public through various means, often against their will, and the particular rights that they have as individuals. I mean, nothing in the data protection law enables governments to do anything. It's their individual personal rights. So I think that the it's quite important to keep those distinct. But what it gets at and what you're saying is that it sort of might encourage those in policy to say, well, if this can be it, if Google can action and modify its index in response to individual requests, surely it could access and modify them in response to public or governmental requests. And there, I think the transparency reporting of Google is really world class. There's extraordinary cases that it's defended all over the world in the public interest, from public officials that are embarrassed by certain information requesting that it be removed from indexes and really just refusing to do so or exiting markets if that's not possible. So I think there's the reporting that we've seen is very strong. Now, we don't know how much there is that isn't being reported and possibly may be happening. I think that the stronger interests that are leading to any reduction in the information environment are much more from things like trademarks. There's been some cases where you can have effectively by default global trademarks without registering in different jurisdictions because you knock out competing domain names and so on, and you can do that directly by making requests to Google to do so, or under the copyright procedures. So yeah, I tend to see them as quite distinct issues, and the issues with, I mean, one big issue that's still at play is the scope of this right to be forgotten request delisting. And the point I just wanted to make about something Ellen said earlier is I think we both agree that really this isn't, information's not being removed. All you're doing is introducing some more hurdles to getting easy access to information that is older or inaccurate, and it's more about obscurity of information. So one way you have obscurity is that you remove it from an index that's accessible on a person's name, and another way that you might do it is limit it jurisdictionally. And Google's practice has been to implement this right just in on access to European domain names, country codes. So if you search google.de or google.co.uk, but not if you search google.com. And I think that's problematic because it sort of underserves and overserves the right to be forgotten, in that you could have, therefore, ready access to the most, you just flip between websites and you can access what it completely undermines the right in many circumstances. But I think more broadly what it shows is we need to make sure that the balances are being applied properly so that you can have some confidence that the information that's being delisted deserves at some level and under some legal jurisdiction to be delisted.
Ellen, do you want to add to that analysis from a U.S. Perspective?
I totally agree with Julie. I really do not see that the right to be forgotten issue and the balance to be struck for individuals between privacy and the public's right to access information easily has much to do with the security concerns. And you know, the question of what role technology platforms are going to play in the war on terrorism, I mean, we see it already in the U.S. as a campaign issue. And, you know, Hillary Clinton, who has always, or has since she was, since her first year as Secretary of State, sort of had deep reach into the technology world. She has called on Silicon Valley to, you know, be more censorious in its treatment of traffic. I think this is going to be a huge issue, and I don't see it having too much to do with data protection.
Julie, I know you have to go in a couple minutes, and so Ellen, I will come back to you in 2 minutes. In fact, Julie, let me ask you this final question. Right, if you were to highlight one or two facts or understandings about information policy broadly that the public discussion of the right to be forgotten and your reporting and advocacy has revealed to us, what would they be?
I think I would really love a big discussion about what is in the public interest in terms of access to a separation of Google from public information. And I think that we've sort of privatized things like our understanding of truth, history, and memory to what is revealed in a Google search result. And that's a real shame. And that separating that out and having a real discussion about it would be really, really great, I think. And the other one is that there's not much understanding at all of European data protection law. And we're about to have a new regulation come in, and it maintains many of the problems of the old directive, which really were formulated in a time pre-internet, and therefore don't provide the sorts of rights that they should in certain circumstances and overextend in others. Essentially creates a system for strict regulation and control of all data transfers, regardless of what impact they have on individuals. So I think that what the right to be one shows is that I really do think that there are some very legitimate cases. I don't think this is about vanity projects of individuals. I think it's that you have a private company assimilating information on individuals and keeping that in a perpetual present. It can be very damaging. And we need to be able to have a legal framework that facilitates individuals having transparent rights with balances that are understood by the various players and that works and is functional in the internet ecosystem. It doesn't have a chilling effect on small operators and so on. And that discussion, I mean, it's kind of getting away from us in that the new regulation is coming in, but I think that the more that we could grapple with in the particular scenarios in which these rights are enlivened, the better the legal framework we'd have. So that's really why I've been trying to get into the weeds a bit of what these cases are. I think there's all the difference in the world between a revenge porn request and a request from an individual about a news story about themselves 2 years ago. And I'd like to be able to separate those.
Julia Powles, I'll also add, you know, the EU also has a new trade secrecy directive, which it opens up a lot of other issues about commercial information and access. Julia, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. We're not done with the show because we're continuing with Ellen.
Thanks so much. Ciao.
Appreciate you being here. Ellen, let me turn to you now, and now you will have an unfettered access to our airwaves here. I do want to turn, and we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, so I really want to get into this, which is, you know, from a U.S. perspective, as you've alluded to, right? There is a challenge here between what the EU has attempted to do with its data directive and U.S. understandings of the First Amendment and speech. I had asked initially, and I kind of want to come back to it and kind of build upon it, right? But we in the United States, and, you know, I'm obviously I live here, and so I tend to think in those terms initially. Initially, right, you know, have laws like Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which allows for speech platforms like Facebook or Google to not be liable for things like defamation so long as they are not considered the speaker, right? We have very strong interests, at least more recently in the last 50 years, as a result of the Freedom of Information Act and things like that, to presume that information is going to be public. And that's a bit different than EU perspectives on things like privacy. How does the First Amendment, in its pure sense, color our analysis from a policy perspective of using something like the right to be forgotten or thinking about information privacy issues from a platform perspective?
Well, I think there are two parts to that. The first one is, you know, doctrinally, if a state or the federal government adopted something like the right to be forgotten, would Google have a First Amendment, a sustainable First Amendment objection to it? And that would depend on whether Google was considered a speaker. And you mentioned Section 230, which sort of pushes the other way, right? Google is seen as a relatively passive platform and not as a speaker. So it's not obvious that you could not have a right to be forgotten that applied merely to platforms and not to publishers. It would get very tricky when it came to social media platforms like Facebook, which is more in the spectrum, is closer to speaker, I think, than Google. But so that's the doctrinal question. I think more importantly, there's sort of the cultural set of biases. And in the U.S., in Europe, privacy is really on a co-equal constitutional footing with free speech. And in the U.S., although, of course, we have the Fourth Amendment, which applies to government actors, there is no real constitutional or clear constitutional footing for privacy vis-a-vis private actors, as they're, you know, in the same way that it's not nearly as robust as our free speech expectations. So in that sense, I think Americans are so biased towards free speech that it's harder. We tend to be more skeptical of a right to be forgotten. And I think in terms of assembling the signatories for this bid to Google to get more transparency on the right to be forgotten, it was very interesting that it tends to be the case that American scholars look at the right to be forgotten more from the perspective of a concern with over-enforcement, and European scholars tend to be more concerned about under-enforcement.
So let's, as we think through where we go from here, Ellen, we've got a lot of challenges here, and we also have a policymaking process which is largely broken because of issues ranging from the role of money inside government and policymaking to the inability of the public to really know exactly what's going on in government. Can we deal with the complexities of a right to be forgotten, and of more broadly the role of platforms, right, and what role those platforms should play given the procedural morass that we find ourselves with at a governmental and policymaking level?
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, I think the deterioration of the public sphere and the sort of ability of government to solve problems, it's actually much bigger than can we solve the problems of technology. It's pushing more problem solving onto these platforms. And so, if we just back out of the right to be forgotten and consider the landscape more broadly, I think you can see in many domains the public's turning to technology platforms to solve problems that we might consider public problems. And so, for example, in some ways we can think of Uber as taking the place or to some extent supplanting regulated taxi cabs. And so then the question becomes, how responsible is Uber going to be to public concerns about the availability of transportation? We can look at some of the telecoms issues around provision of broadband and affordable broadband, the responsibilities for doing that being pushed away from sort of a universal service, government subsidy or government regulated realm to the private telecom platform and broadband policy, the policies that they voluntarily adopt. And then we have questions about whether they're sufficient and whether they do the job. Same thing, we raised the question of the role of technology platforms in terms of dealing with terrorist communications. And so in all these realms, I think technology platforms are playing a larger and larger part, maybe because government is unable to do it. And then, I think it puts even a greater onus on the companies themselves, on the public, to, if they can't be regulated, if government is unable to do that, at least to make transparency the second best.
So, Ellen, let me close on this question, and we're well into what I call the unfair portion of the show, which is when I really ask you questions you can't answer in time. So I'm going to ask you for a 60-second answer to roughly the same question that I asked Julia before she departed, which was, what one lesson can we take from the challenge of implementing a right to be forgotten in the EU?
Dave?
Yes. I'm sorry. Did you hear that question?
The question?
Yes. What would be the big takeaway that you would have for U.S. policymakers and really people listening to the show about the challenge of implementing this quote unquote right?
Well, I think expecting technology companies to fairly balance long-standing and really difficult conflicting public policy goals, just handing it to them and telling them to go forth and do it, is the wrong way to go, unless that order is going to be accompanied by accountability and transparency requirements so that the public can know if it's being done right.
Ellen, I appreciate the time you've taken today to discuss this fascinating and wide-ranging issue. I'm offering this invitation to Julia in absentia, but I'll offer it to you as well, which is, obviously, this is the beginning of larger discussions. So I invite you back on the show to continue the discussion. I appreciate you taking the time today, and I look forward to continuing the discussion down the road.
Thanks for having me. Great being with you.
So we have an interesting schedule coming up on Hearsay Culture for this trimester, this quarter that we have on the schedule. Hearsay Culture is a show which is unbelievably coming up on its 250th show, which kind of blows me away that that's actually happened. And I'm going to have some very exciting news with regard to the 10th anniversary show for Hearsay Culture, which I'll be announcing probably on the next show. But for now, the remaining guests for this quarter include Sam Brailowski of the Library of Congress's National Sound Preservation Board on audio preservation and copyright law, Lorelei Kelly of the New America Foundation and the Edward M. Kennedy Institute on technology, legislative decision-making, and resilient governance, as well as Dave King, the drummer for the Bad Plus and the host of the show Rational Funk. And we're going to be talking about media and the music business. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show this quarter, Fridays at 2 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU. You could also get the show by going to the cyberlaw.stanford.edu CIS webpage and by going to the iTunes search engine where you can find all of Hearsay Culture's shows. Thank you for bearing with me as I'm fighting a bit of a cold today. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback, including your cold remedies, by going to the contact page on hearsayculture.com or by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.